बहुत सुंदर तरीके से कम्युनिकेशन सब्जेक्ट के बारे में हेल्थ सेक्टर में किस प्रकार से मैटर करता है उसके कुछ टिप्स शेयर किए थे। आज फिर इस टॉपिक पे हमारे साथ इंटरेक्शंस रहेगा। ओवर टू यू भाई साहब।
थैंक यू। कैन यू हियर मी? या ओके। इफ यू हैड अ चॉइस हाउ मेनी ऑफ यू वुड कम टू दिस लेसन एट 5 o'clock? After the very useful treatment in the hospital, treat.
Refresh,
okay. Okay, I went back yesterday and obviously I was halfway through what I wanted to say. I could only realize that I have only covered 13 slides in 1 hour. That's too bad. But then immediately positive thinking, so I said that's good. Because you were with me. I was trying to communicate what I wanted to say. It doesn't matter how much, how far in the line I could go. And for these 2 sessions, I had prepared 100 slides. So I probably will go another 12 or 13, but doesn't matter. But we'll take it slowly and go through some of the key things, because I gave some ideas yesterday about sensitivity, the topics, the settings, and the sensitive ways of trying to communicate. I'll stay with that topic, but I also would like to address what I have called here the ethics of care. I think we have been talking quite a bit this morning about self-care, but also caring for the patient, caring for the families, caring for society as part of our commitment, the role and responsibilities of doctors in any society. So I'll explore that, but as usual, I'll try to give 2 concrete examples so that it makes sense to some of the things that I want to talk about. So I'll go through this where we stopped yesterday. I think we were trying to summarize that the art of communication and the science of communication, we need both. So there needs to be some awareness, some training, some education about how to communicate. Good news, bad news, sensitive, not so sensitive, but we need to know, and there is always a way to develop the way we communicate, including myself. There's no end to these life skills. Communicating is a life skill. If one is good at communication at home, they actually could be very good at work, but it could be both. You are not a good communicator in the family, and it almost transfers or translates into your workplace. So we said healthcare communication is both an art and a science. If it is an innate quality, you are born with it, great. But of course people can improve by learning the science of communication. And I also said that communication is always dependent on that situation, that context. No matter how much training you have had, it may not work at that particular moment. So each moment is unique. Each patient is unique, and that is where the challenge is both an opportunity in terms of trying to be innovative, trying to be creative, and you can also see if you are listening, and this is one aspect that I will explore, active listening, or how can we listen to what patients are saying and not saying, and why they are not saying what they should say. So the next question I was going to ask yesterday, which I start today with, you could be a very good professional in your own field of expertise, but there is no guarantee that that equates, translates one-to-one as a good communicator. I'm very convinced in my own life, in my own experience, there are lovely, nice doctors and nice communicators as well. But these two we cannot take for granted. So if a good professional equals a good communicator, well and good. That's exactly the ideal. That applies not just to doctors, to professors, to social workers, to nurses, everybody. Professionals need to communicate their professionalism, that they can show that they are professionally competent, expert, and concerned, caring. But of course, the context, as I said, could be very different. He wanted, like the example I gave yesterday about the cardiologist, who wanted to do things well, but the circumstances didn't allow. I'm sure in government hospitals, I was asking some colleagues today, when we're walking through the global hospital, how would it compare to a government hospital in Odisha? Probably not, because it looked very quiet, very clean. I didn't get the smell of the hospital, which is very important. You enter a hospital, you get the smell first. And then you look around, it's all people. You can't distinguish between people and patients. There could be more people than patients. So overcrowdedness, smell, people running around or rushing around, some kind of disorder. Everything looked very neat. I almost told Dr. Midha, I've already met him 3 times. He was here yesterday at this lecture. Then he said, good to see you again. I said, I would like to be a patient and come back here. That would be a new experience. And then after the treat, I said, I wouldn't mind being here. If you can get pakoras in hospitals, that is something I didn't expect. So when we think about a good professional and good communicator, try to reverse that. Suppose somebody is a good communicator, but professionally not competent. They lack the knowledge, the experience, but they're so good in talking, like politicians. Then that is dangerous. So when I go for training doctors in different areas, communication training, I always tell them, I do not want to turn you into good communicators. Because that's risky for the patients. Because behind that good communication, that mask, people might trust you more. And you don't know the knowledge. A very quick example, a very real example, and this was in Sweden. And a professor, colleague of mine, 40 plus, was diagnosed with cancer. She wasn't a professor of communication or language. So she wanted to say to my colleague, another colleague who is a professor in communication, could you come with me to the consultation? I need somebody to help me understand, digest what will happen in the clinic. And this patient, the cancer patient, was given 2 options. She could either have appointments, because it would be a routine, a set of appointments, continuity, with the head of the institute, the Karolinska Institute, if you have heard, that is the best cancer institute in Stockholm. So she would be given the opportunity to have all her consultations with the head consultant, the chief consultant. Or she could have it with a young, upcoming consultant. The difference between the two was this young one was very sweet in communication. He had a style to communicate, particularly in these situations. The head was not bad, but didn't have time and would just do it like a business, like usual. So this patient chose the young person, even knowing that he may not know everything that might be there, whereas the senior person, the senior physician, might catch new things or might be more aware of things as it is developing. So that means people can often choose a good communicator. But behind that good communication, there may be a lack of expertise, a lack of interest, a lack of something else. So it is not a question of either or. It's really a matter of trying to think about both as part of your integrated, embodied quality of practice, not just healthcare, social care, nursing, and so on. And when I'm talking about communication, not just with patients, like I said yesterday, with colleagues, teams, with the management, and so on, but it's also not talk. It can be many other things, writing and notes and whatnot. So why am I talking about communication? And one of the things that both in research and in terms of policies, communication is increasingly being seen as an inherent component of a doctor's skill set. It's becoming compulsory in all medical education. Of course, at different levels, whether it's palliative care or cancer or something else. So why is it at the heart of healthcare delivery? Why should we bother about communication? If we know medicine, if we have got our degree, if we know what we do, why do we bother how to communicate it?
Because name and fame of the institution is there.
Of course, you represent the institution. The way you communicate, almost the institution is communicating, the organization is communicating. People would say by word of mouth, go to that hospital.
We are the face of the hospital.
Absolutely. You are the living organism of the hospital. Hospital is a building. But it's the people, even though it's an environment and has an ambience, I'm sure those people who are working there, if I had sat with them and talked to them, I would have got the same vibe, that they are mostly doing things in a very, not casual or indifferent way, but doing things in a cool way. They probably don't show much anxiety or anxiousness or probably burnout. Okay, so just think about your own practice, and you don't have to read all this, I can just summarize, and you will have the slides as I have promised, so you don't have to take in everything. So think about your daily routine, how much time you actually spend in talking and writing, and even on the phone, which is all language and communication. Listening to the patient, taking history, writing down whatever you want, maintaining the patient records, giving a diagnosis. These are all communicative action. You have to use language to tell what you found, what is not so bad, to reassure the patients, but also to say what they should take seriously, what has to be happening. So diagnosis, prognosis, writing a prescription is in language. There has been quite a bit of research about why doctors write in such bad handwriting. Because there is a good reason. The good reason being that there will be less litigation. So until prescriptions in the UK, and I'm sure in India, now it is all electronic
or typed.
And more the pharmacists find problems and errors in doctors' prescriptions. But they're very afraid of blowing the whistle because doctors are senior and it will somehow affect the relationship. So basically the question is, all this requires your communicative writing, speaking, telephoning the emergency services. You can only talk in language because you can't show anything. Okay. Or following a complaint. That's also a matter of language and so on. Even in public health setting, language becomes absolutely central, like the COVID-19 pandemic. How much information, including disinformation and misinformation, people believed because of the language in the press, in the TV, from the politicians, from the public health physicians, and so on and so forth. So language becomes important not only in the clinic and the hospital, but also in the public, societal sphere, but as well as for the patients, the personal life. They can only talk about their experience of illness through language and gesture and so on. So it becomes very important communication because of many uncertainties and risks. As we grow in year by year, decade by decade, we still don't know. There are so many things that we don't know the cause of. So many syndromes, chronic fatigue syndrome, long COVID, Gulf syndrome, you can just name the phantom limb. We don't know what causes them, whether they're real, but it can only make sense through some kind of communication because there are still no diagnoses or still no tests available for these very uncertain and complex conditions. Then, as I said, now the patients are assumed to be literate. They have already read something in the YouTube, in the internet, before they come to you. What they want is, can you convince them that what they know is not right for them? It doesn't apply to them. So it becomes, the communication becomes not talking down, telling them, explaining, but actually trying to make them understand that what you have read is true, but it doesn't apply to you. Yours is a unique case. So these are the kind of, and as I said, with mis and disinformation, health scares and panics in the media and health technology, with increasing speed and credibility, actually language and communication is shaping our knowledge of what we know about our body, what we know about diseases and illnesses. So the question then becomes, can good or bad communication become a predictor of patient outcome, because that's very crucial. Does it matter how I communicate? Is it going to make an effect or in any way influence the outcome for the patient. Surely if it doesn't, then we shouldn't bother, we shouldn't waste time. But actually it does. In both ways, that bad communication, and there are many studies, at least I can cite from Europe, many studies report that there is a strong association between bad communication, poor communication, and adverse outcomes which could have been prevented, avoided. So bad communication might mean somebody doesn't follow the treatment routine, or somebody even takes suicidal thoughts, or, I mean, one of the studies in the UK has shown that type 2 diabetes patients do not follow the treatment regime because it's not going to cure them. Diabetes too cannot be cured, it can only be managed. So why bother taking medication all your life, which will have some side effects anyway? So that's their rational thinking, why they stop or interrupt that treatment. So basically poor communication, if they have not told properly why they should manage their diabetes, not because diabetes will be cured, but something else can be prevented. But if they haven't understood that through communication, then they are going to either not take it or stop doing it, or probably ignore the advice or not comply with the prescription. But on a positive note, many studies have shown that good communication can contribute to favorable, positive patient outcomes, particularly in complying with the treatment. So in that sense, you could argue that as we prepare the doctors for tomorrow through medical education, we not only train them in a clinical mindset, but also a communicative mindset. That is very important, that your clinical mindset has to be communicated. You can also add a caring mindset, not just communicative. Can you be more caring, more humane in dealing with patients with all the knowledge you have? So I'll very quickly show a little bit, and this part, if you're interested, we can talk more, or again, you will have the slides. I just want to show you where medical practice, medical science is moving in the past 30, 40 years. There is a dominant paradigm, and there are a few not so dominant paradigms. So the most dominant paradigm is the evidence-based medicine. That is what would come naturally to you. You believe in what you see as evidence. So that means everything can be seen in biomedical terms. That's evidence. As a kind of a reaction to this, over the past 15 to 20 years, more and more in US and elsewhere, what is now being called humanities-based medicine, or medical humanities, or humanities and medicine. You can call it by any name, but they're coming from a more humanities perspective, not just biomedical. So biomedical is very restrictive. It is only looking at the body, not the whole person, the cell, not the whole being, and so on and so forth. So humanities-based medicine would become a little bit more demedicalized. There is something more than medical in somebody's condition that we can look at people's experience, not just evidence. So can the patient's experience be evidence for our practice? Can we treat as evidence? And that's where the challenge is, or the debate is. So now more and more in the West, we talk about patient-centered care, patient-centered medicine, family-centered medicine, shared decision-making. All these concepts mean that we treat patients as human beings, not as patients. So the more and more we move towards treating people as human beings, that's the humanities-based medicine. And within that, you can say what is called narrative medicine. Again, I'll say very briefly on what that is, or narrative evidence-based medicine, and then communication-based medicine. There is a classic book actually written by two doctors in 1970s, Doctors Talking to Patients. So Byrne and Long, 1976, two GPs, they showed that if doctors follow their agenda of history taking and diagnosis, physical exam diagnosis and so on, they will not be listening to the patients because they're driven by their own agenda. Most doctors make a hypothesis in 2 seconds, and then they only seek information to validate or invalidate that hypothesis. You cannot get away from that. So that way you are bound to listen selectively to what the patient is saying. Only that fits within your hypothesis, the rest simply goes by one ear to the other. So they said that if doctors follow the rigid agenda, history taking, physical examination and so on, and I'll come to a very concrete example in the case of antibiotics prescriptions in UK. So if they do that during the consultation, it will prevent them from listening to their patients. Forget about active or attentive listening. They're not even listening. They're busy simply doing, getting it to a point as quickly as they can. So patient-centered medicine is nothing new. It started in 1970s. They said there should be a patient-centered model for clinical practice where doctors listen. And that would make a liberal humanist kind of a paradigm shift. Evidence-based medicine is the benchmark of clinical practice, but the practice of evidence-based medicine simply means that you have the personal individual expertise, but that expertise must be complemented with the best available scientific evidence systematically, through systematic research. Clinical trials, cohort research, whatever it is that you do, that external evidence must attest your individual expertise. Otherwise, individual expertise in itself is not enough. So that means it has to be based on research-based evidence. But note that the notion of evidence in EBM is evidence about the population. Okay, clinical trials tell us something about the population, not about individuals. But each consultation is about individuals and their family. So how do you translate population-based evidence into a particular patient's concerns, a particular patient's condition? Because clinical practice in any specialism is about individual patients and their family members. So the concern is the gap between biomedical research, what we would call blue sky research. Let's spend millions of pounds on genomics or something else. And the more and more money is spent on biomedical research, there is a gap between what we find and what can actually be applied to clinical practice in hospitals, in Odisha government hospitals and so on. So this gap, and this was a professor, David Wetherall, in Oxford, a very well-known professor. He said, when the emphasis in medical research is shifting from the patient to the cells, stem cells, the more and more research is based on stem cells, then you are basically forgetting the patient as a human being. So the more the study of disease is shifting from the level of the patient to diseased organs or even to their cells and molecules, then it would be a very reductionist approach, what you might call a biomedical determinism, because there is more to a patient's experience of illness than just the biomedical cellular molecular structure. Hence, now people talk about translational medicine. Have you heard this? Translational medicine. This is big in the West. How can we translate medical research into clinical practice? I would even go further and say, more and more we should translate clinical practice into biomedical research. What we see, what we observe in the clinic must become research topics. So there are two things as part of this kind of a capacity building. I would really suggest, both at the level of the government and you as associations and groups, is two things, research and reflection. We need research, not just common sense, not just sharing things. We need evidence that this works and this doesn't. And if these research topics come from the practice, clinical arena, clinical realm, they're even more useful because you know that's the problem, so you make it a research topic and you reflect on this and this translates back into this. So translational medicine becomes very important. Then a huge shift happened in 1977. This is a big name, George Engel. And he said that there is a lot of reductionism in a biomedical evidence-based model. So let us move from that, and this is why he used a term called biopsychosocial. We can't ignore the biomedical aspect, but let's add the psychosocial element as well. So health and healthcare must be both biomedical, the somatic and psychological, social and so on. So this biopsychosocial is trying to understand the patient as a human being. I think this is easily said than done, but that is exactly what humanities-based medicine tries to preach. Let's treat every patient as a human being, a unique human being. And in humanities-based medicine, medical humanities, what counts most is not scientific evidence systematically collected, but the experience of the patient. How does the patient experience the pain? Even when you say, in a scale of 1 to 10, where is your pain? They don't experience in a scale. So we have to listen to their pain. They may not have the language. It's very difficult to describe pain. Many languages don't have that many words to tell exactly the intensity, the suffering. So how can they put it into a 1 to 10 scale? So this is where you move from evidence-based medicine, the biomedical evidence-based practice, to experience-based medicine. That means focusing on the patient. And what keeps, somebody called Arthur Kleinman, who was both a doctor and an anthropologist. Okay, so he went into the exotic lands, exotic countries, and tried to study with his own medical expertise how people make sense of their illnesses. And he has written extensively, Arthur Kleinman, basically says that actually, because he was both a clinician and a sociologist, anthropologist, he said what is of interest to both is their interest in the micro level of experience. So the primacy of experience is the lived experience of the patient. You try to observe it, you try to get into their shoes, and the term philosophically is experiential phenomenology. So that's the uniqueness. That's the uniqueness of each patient. We as doctors have to enter into the world of the sick person. But how do you do that? It's easily said than done. And this is something that you might want to relate to or even question or think about. And he said that doctors are like observational scientists. We observe as doctors. We're not experimenting on our patients. So the difference between observing and experimenting is between the laboratory scientist and the clinician. There is a huge difference. So those of you who are both doing clinical research and a clinical practice, you might find that sometimes you have to wear two different hats because there is a conflict, ethics and morally as well. So doctors are like observational scientists than experimentalists. Like the poet and the painter, they are strongly drawn to the details of perception. So you must be looking at the patient and their fingers and their legs. Something is happening, twitching or something. That attracts you. Particularly in genetics, I've seen that how the face becomes more important because there are no tests available. So just observing to the face, they take photographs and so on, then that becomes almost like a painter or like a poet. You look at the details, the minute details, at the nano level, not even at the micro level, at as much detail as you can. And humanities-based medicine can deal with so many things. I think you have heard some of these terms. But these terms have to be unpacked, practiced, and theoretically, but also practically and analytically. Mindfulness, I mentioned reflections, the notion of presence. Just a quick example, a consultant in a very critical situation actually speaks very few words. A junior doctor is the opposite. They don't stop talking. The consultant is present. If you have concerns, If you ask me, then I will respond. I don't want to tell you all I know. But go to an ICU which is filled with junior doctors, wrong hours. This is their kind of trap. And when you get to them and with the ICU, they talk like a textbook. They want to show everything they know. You know why this is jumping up and down on this? There could be 12 reasons. Then they give you all the 12 reasons, by which time you are totally not interested. One of the reasons is that they do not want to create space, silence, because they could be asked difficult questions. So by talking a lot, you can avoid sensitive questions. That's an interesting strategy. The more you talk, you don't allow people to ask questions because those questions are going to be very difficult and sensitive, and you don't have answers. So presence, compassion, empathy, values, art and drama, aesthetics, narratives and communication, there could be a lot more. So narrative-based medicine then became, or now is becoming, quite dominant, but not as dominant as evidence-based practice. So here, basically, the core of the message is the difference between disease and illness. Disease is a biomedical condition. Okay, it's a disorder in the system. Illness is the experience of the patient. The same disease can be experienced very differently by different people from different class, different professions. Okay, if you're a sportsman and you lose your limb, that experience is very different from being a professor and losing a limb. So each disease affects people differently. So then this saying, patients suffer diseases, doctors diagnose and treat diseases. Sorry, patients suffer illnesses and doctors diagnose and treat diseases. Disease and illness do not stand in a one-to-one relationship, and that is why it's unique in each individual context. And that's another classic book called The Discourse of Medicine by Elliot Mishler. He talks about two different things that happens in any clinic. If you go back and reflect on any of your consultations, you will find this. One is what he calls the voice of medicine, the biomedical, the very technical, scientific aspects of what you see. But there is always going to be the everyday things. This patient has lost something, has happened this 3 years ago, that is also in the room. So the voice of medicine and the voice of the life world. And what you are being addressed here in these last 3-4 days is actually your life world. You don't need to come here to learn about the technical aspects of your expertise. This is not the place. But your life world is also crowded either with stress, burnouts, workload, queues, administrative burdens, and so on and so forth. So how do you manage that life world? And that can go into the level of the voice of medicine. So that brings me to this aspect of the talk I wanted to call the ethics of care. And this goes back to the Hippocratic Oath. If you look at the oath itself in detail, I have picked out two sentences or two paragraphs which directly speaks to the caring aspect of your profession. I will remember that there is art to medicine as well as science, and that warmth, sympathy and understanding may outweigh the surgeon's knife or the chemist's drug. So it's not just there, it can outweigh, it can actually overcome, overpower. I'll remember that I do not treat a fever chart, a cancerous growth, but a sick human being. So not just that little part of the body, but the whole person, because that body is for the whole person. But a sick human being whose illness may affect the person's family and economic stability. My responsibility includes these related problems if I'm to care adequately for the sick. So caring is part of what you have taken as your oath in the profession. We also, interestingly, call our system health care. Care is there, not just health, health care. And your profession is often called the caring profession. That's how we refer to, at least in the UK, the caring profession. So care is instrumental, fundamental, integral to your being, to your identity, to your roles. And long back in 1957, the American Medical Association Code highlighted this aspect. The virtues of care, human nature, and urged the physician to be pure in character. Much of the discussions that is going on here, if your spiritual being can be uplifted, elevated, that's great, because then you can be diligent and conscientious in caring for the sick. So the care keeps coming back into the profession. And care is not about cure as such. It's caring for the person that is in need of something. So what happens when people become sick? They become vulnerable. They are vulnerable in terms of their system, the biochemical system, if you like, but they're also vulnerable in terms psychologically and emotionally, not just somatically. And the vulnerability might be increased if it's an elder patient, if it's a child, if patients with life-limiting conditions, disabilities, different backgrounds, classes, and so on. So they could be much more vulnerable than the middle-class literate patients. Well, how do you treat them differently? But they can also be vulnerable when it comes to communicating and explaining things. Not many patients would understand, even if you want to try to understand them. So in this situations, caring becomes an unconditional necessity when a person occupies the sick role. So when somebody is sick and there is sociological literature, somebody called Talcott Parsons, and these studies go back a long way, 50, 60 years. He said there are four things when a person falls sick or ill. First, we have to recognize that the person is not well, so they must be given sick leave. We call sick leave. So sick leave has to be proportionate to the intensity or the nature of the condition. You can't give sick leave for 6 months if you have a cough. So sick leave is basically to say that you are exempted from your normal duties. You don't need to go to work, you don't need to do this, and until you get better. At the same time, you can't give responsibility to the patient to get better by themselves. They can't, even if they want to. So you have to accept that he is in a condition that must be taken care of. Again, see the word care. So something has to be done about him. Can't be left alone and get better on their own. And thirdly, the person, the sick person, also has a moral commitment that they must accept that being sick for too long is not desirable. They must try, and basically that means they must comply with the doctor, with the prescription, and want or even obliged to get well. And finally, they must seek technical help. So going to the doctor and getting a prescription is one of the four things. The responsibility spreads over the patient, the family who should take care of, but also the doctor. So the ethics of care is basically moving away from just obligations and duties. It's something extra, something additional. And that simply means being responsive. Don't close your eyes and minds. Try to be responsive, or what is often called open responsiveness. And that responsiveness is towards the needs of the patient. And therefore, sometimes you have to accept that what you might think as medically right may not work for them, because their needs and the nature of their condition is something beyond what is best for you. And that, I had said yesterday, is the notion of self and the other. I think this part I will be very quick. One key element of the medical profession is altruism. That you are other-oriented, you are doing something for the society, of course you get a salary and all the rest of it, but but you are not doing it just for the money. There has to be something that we would call altruistic, other orientation. And when we talk about the other, the self and the other, they live together. You can't separate them, which is called a social theory of self. An American philosopher called George Herbert Mead, 1934, almost 100 years ago, still right. So rather than thinking self is something that is individualistic, self is something that is very social. And two things he said, and I summarized there just in highlight, that the self is not born when a child is born. There is no self in a child as the child is born. The child socializes, and this is how the self develops. So by interacting with other people, the mother, the family, the strangers, the dog, the cat, they acquire the self. So self becomes a social development. It's not there at birth as such. And how does it develop? In order to develop, you need an other. So anybody, and he called it the generalized other, the society. So you need an other. The other becomes a mirror through which you see yourself. And even when we dress up for the day, I'm dressing up for the others. Otherwise, I won't care. So the self tries to think of the other to model itself. The unity of self is always in response to the other, the generalized other, and sometimes we talk about the significant other, those who matter to us more. So with that in mind, a classic, and I think this is called the Bible of Medical Ethics by Beauchamp and Childress. This book came out in 1979, Principles of Biomedical Ethics. And one chapter is devoted to this ethics of care. And what they're saying, that ethics of care is about relationships and responsibilities. Try to dissect the word responsibility. It is the ability to respond. Response, ability. So this response is a token of your engagement with a relationship, the relationship between you and the patient, for instance. And that responsiveness is what they call contextual at the moment. And another term you could use is the situational awareness. And this cannot be taught. It cannot be in the code of conduct, code of practice. And it's not just about the principle of beneficence, trying to be helpful. So there's something that has to be integral and embodied to be responsive immediately, immediate response if you like. And that means you have to be engaged, contextual and passionate about what you're doing. And another classic book from a Dutch philosopher called The Logic of Care, Anne-Marie Mohl. And he says, more and more we are moving away from the ethics of care to the ethics or logic of choice, particularly in the West. So most doctors, most clinics are all about what are the choices. Remember the shared decision making, which has to be premised on what choices are available. So what are the choices? But the more we become driven by choices, it's all about patient's right, patient's autonomy, the less you become careful. You could be indifferent and even neglect the patients. If you allow the patients to be making the right choices, and actually patients are becoming increasingly like consumers, not patients. If they want something, you know that it will do more harm than good. How are you going to handle this? So when it comes to this position, then in the name of patient autonomy, patient-centeredness, you might be accused of being irresponsible, indifferent, or even negligent. And that's the challenge between the logic of care and the logic of choice. And then they said, of course, you can be both patient-centered and caring. It can happen, but most often these two things clash. There is a tension. What the patient wants and what you think might be the best thing for them. So care is not cure. However, both can go together. Actually, caring can cure people. So one of the challenges we have, I was talking to Mr. Ponder, I think, in the bus. We were talking about what is this department called, and said it's called Health and Family Welfare? Yeah, Family Welfare. I said, okay, in the UK we would have health is always different, then it's social welfare. And these two, in many conditions, as we know, need to be connected, particularly during COVID-19. Many people died because these two departments didn't talk to them. So they were blocking the hospital beds because the social care was not prepared to take them to nursing homes. And then when they dispatched them, they were not fully cured, but they suppressed the information and then they spread. So health care and social care. I'm always fascinated, healthcare be a one word, but social care doesn't become a one word, it's a two words. And these two, when they don't talk to each other, then something falls in the crack, in the gap. But then the question we can ask, I'll see if I can get to a couple of examples. Why should health professionals adopt a caring mentality? Why should we care? And I think because every condition, every disease, every patient doesn't just bring a disease, but they bring a social context with them. So because the socio-psychological aspects of illness is so real, we need to have a caring attitude, a caring mentality. Yet another book, and I'll summarize, it says that when the patient comes to the clinic, they just don't come with a disease. They come with what he calls the social context. That could mean that there are physical problems, problems at work, in the family, in the wider community. So all that might be contributing factors to what this, particularly in psychiatry and other kinds of psychological illnesses. So a patient's experience of physical problems is inseparable from the wider social context in which these problems occur. But even though doctors know that, they just are reluctant to get too much into the social issues, either because of time and workload, but also because they don't have expertise. They're not all counselors. You don't want to listen to everybody's worries in a clinical setting which you can't do anything about. So what he argues that many doctors recognize that delving into their personal social problems will become almost difficult for them to bear or to manage. So they feel uncomfortable. So in order to remain comfortable, they just want to get quickly into the technical side. Right, have you taken a blood? Let's look at your urine sample. So that they feel comfortable. So not medicalizing these social problems is something that doctors feel comfortable about, but it also means that something becomes unspoken and unaddressed in a particular consultation. So I said we can try and understand what we mean by listening. I think we are talking about we can hear but we are not listening. Then people talk about active listening or attentive listening. How do we understand or how do we make sense of this? So one thing that we can do, if every condition has a biopsychosocial aspect, then we have to listen to the patient, their experience, their stories. William Osler, who is called the father of medicine, listen to the patient, he is telling you the diagnosis. And there have been very interesting studies to show that doctors usually take only 18 seconds to interrupt the patient. So they don't have patience to hear the whole symptoms. 18 seconds. This study was replicated some 20 years later. This was 1984, then sometime in 2010, 2018 or something like that. It has gone up to 22 seconds.
But here I think it is less than that.
I'm sure.
5 seconds or 3 seconds?
Absolutely. So this is the reason, that is what I meant.
Sir,
sir, I will give you an example. When I joined in the job,
what?
At Basudapur, Matra, one of my senior intern medical expert is there. He used to ask, what is there? I write the paragraph, and somebody said, oh, fully at the other way. But like only 2 to 3 seconds, he used to see 200-300
patients in 1 hour or 2 hours. But this question, when did it begin, which is the beginning of the history taking? When did you feel like this? But once you start to that, the patient's story is interrupted. They might have had something to say, but this is also cultural. Chinese people, when they come to the UK, Chinese medicine is based on no talk. They look at you, and the less you say, the better the physician. So if the doctor asks, what's the problem with you, the Chinese people become skeptical. No, because they think that the doctor doesn't know. If I know, then why should I come to you? So it's very cultural as well. But what I basically say is, I could tell you, please actively listen to the patient. But then you go back to the clinic, and you ask the question, after 15 seconds or 5 seconds or 10 seconds, that means you are not ready yet to listen for whatever reason, the long queues, the many patients, the noise, and so on and so forth. So these things are not easy. It can be said. So I'll tell you one example. It is not about active listening, but what difference it makes. It can be a differential diagnosis. If I tell you that if you listen to the story of the patient, the experience, you could come up with a different diagnosis, then you have to listen. So unless we try to connect these two, but only say active listening is a good quality, it's not going to happen. So let me give you a concrete example. And this is how I work, okay? So you look at the doctor-patient talk, you record it, you transcribe it, you look at what's happening. Can we see that active listening is happening here or not? Number one, did it make a difference to what happened? If it did, then I would take home this message. In some instances, I must allow the patient to tell their whole story. So this is a case of a seizure, blackout, and the man is a car mechanic. So when he comes to the clinic, there is a black eye. So as it might have happened, so you could look at the face and say, perhaps when he had the seizure, he was not in control, involuntary, he fell. And they're actually in epileptic clinic, the best evidence is from the observer, not from the patient, because they can't tell what happened. So has anybody observed you falling or having the seizure, and will take their evidence if it is functional rather than just a blackout. If it is a organic, functional epileptic seizure, we must find out what happened and how it happened. So in this case, the resident doctor, this is from the US, says, okay, you said you had a seizure yesterday. And then the patient says, yes, it's about yesterday, 11 o'clock, at work. So this is already, you can see, they're having a conversation, already listening. Okay. Well, I'm not really worried about this thing. You told me that I'm not getting upset and aggravated. Then he says something like, my boss gave me a car, which has nothing to do with. That's the story, which you could say, forget it. Tell me, okay, that's it. Now I do some examination or write a prescription. In this case, the patient says, my boss gave me a car Tuesday, right? I'm working on it. It was an Audi. I never did brakes on an Audi before. You know front wheel drive? So now the topic and the nature of the conversation has changed. So basically, when you want to be active listener, you have to take the position of a story recipient, like mothers and grandmothers telling stories. Stories can't be told if you are not listening. So how do you take a listening attitude to somehow block, stop all your medical thinking and questions, to hold them back? So now, he says, front wheel drive, yeah. And it was a problem, you know, I was down all day long, back like this here, like the car is on a lift. the forklift, but it was the two bolts, you know, just can't get them unless you get right up to the caliper, and it was just can't twist a little bit with a screwdriver. And I was going, and then I got a black eye. So the black eye was not because of the seizure. That's very important. So the black eye, so remember, see how the doctor said, oh, because he was surprised. He had already made the hypothesis that the black eye must be caused by the seizure. Oh, from the seizure? No, from the caliper. One of them fell to the eye. Oh, I see. So that transformed the nature of the treatment, the diagnosis, and so on. So active listening means having patience, allowing the patient to tell a story, their story, and that could make a difference in terms of what diagnosis. And then it just continued, and then when said, that's when I ended up having the seizure. Okay. And that is where the doctor begins to ask the question, has anybody observed you having the seizure? Because that's important. So this is what I mean by active listening. You can look at it in your own practice. You can analyze it. And I've tried to experiment that in the context of palliative care. This is done by my palliative doctors. I'm just giving one example. I just tell them, record your session. Okay. Then try to put on one side what you said, the doctor, and what the patient said. See how much of arrows can you connect. Because that would show that you are listening. So if you look at this, the patient, so your oncologist, I wonder why you came to see me, says, I wanted something strong, painkillers, rather than Tylex. Immediately, the doctor picks on that. Okay, Tylex. And then he says he has constipation and has tried some prune juice. Who started the Tylex? The GP. Okay. And then I had pain. I went to Birmingham, so full of hope. Suddenly it looked like it came as a bit of shock. Okay. So Tylex is the medical side. A bit of shock is emotional, psychological, the family side. And that, again, the doctor picks up. This one is not working. You can see, okay, you said it comes as a bit of shock. Can you tell me a bit more? So this is what I mean by you can evidence active listening in your own consultation and reflect on it. If you think that you didn't connect that much, the patient said something, you forgot, the patient had to ask again. Remember I said I had a bit of a shock? So that means you are not listening to their concerns. Then you can say, okay, maybe next time I'll try to make as many connections. And I think that's a simple exercise doctors themselves did as part of their reflection and talking about, this one is not working anymore. Okay, let's see. And this is something I'm quoting on the Hippocratic Oath I started with. And just listen to this part. A physician and a patient, they have a social contract. And this social contract or the social system means that the doctor must not only appear to be, but must really be in what the patient says, in your whole attention. Don't just pretend that you are listening. How do you do that? And this is what in humanity is called the presence, that you are totally focused and attentive. The doctor must not only appear to be, but must really be in what the patient says. In your interview, in the consultation, look for what the patient wants to tell, for implications of what he does not want to tell, and thirdly, what he cannot tell. Because not all patients can tell everything. So there might be, it's like reading between the lines. So if you want to follow this famous Atul Guande talks about the checklist manifesto in surgery, particularly in his case, but also in all kinds of specialism. And that takes us back to the rigid agenda of medical clinical practice. The more I tick the agenda, have I done this, have I done that, and have I done that, that is very good, it has virtue, but it might alienate the patient and their social context. So there is a serious risk in trying to be too procedural, too systematic, following the guideline, following the checklist. So we also have to think about our judgment and intuition. And this is a classic piece of work by somebody called Donald Schoen, the reflective practitioner. How professionals think in action. You are a thinking individual when you are doing your clinics. So that's what he calls reflecting in practice. Before you ask the next question, you're already reflecting on what the response was to the previous question. So that's a kind of reflection in practice. And then you reflect on practice afterwards. Could I have asked the question differently? Could I have given the explanation differently? And so on. So reflective practice, not as I said, is a key to trying to understand what you do and what you can do better. Okay, have we got time for one example, or I don't see anybody telling us. Are you okay for me to go through? We'll go on for this example. I want to show you this one. And it has a very interesting story about it. This is a group of GPs who came to me. I was not going to ask them to give me data or anything else. They came to me because they realized that they're over-prescribing antibiotics to children. I think this is very universal. Parents are very anxious. They think antibiotics can help, particularly with two-income families. If they both have to go to work, let the child sleep because I can't afford to take leave again. I have a board meeting or something else. So this became a social issue, not just a medical issue. And we know the harm that can do to children. They become resistant and blah, blah, blah. So they came to me that we know that we're over-prescribing, but we're somehow forced by the parents. So it's actually a communication problem. They talk in such a way that we have no choice but to prescribe. They won't leave the clinic. They will say, why are we, this is all meant to be free, National Health Service, so why don't you prescribe? So this became such a concern. They gave me 200 transcripts they had recorded. So you look at them and tell us, what can we do better to reduce overprescription? So within those 200, there are cases of prescription and cases of non-prescription. Okay, so I want to take you through that. Well, what's interesting is this study became so popular that the government in where I live in Wales, they always invite the researchers from the university to give a talk to the bureaucrats, the politicians and so on, what can be put into policies. So we actually have a day, university professors selectively would go and give a presentation to ministers and typical bureaucrats and so on. I called it, when talk is cheaper than antibiotics. And that attracted the attention of the politicians and policymakers. So can we save money by talking? I said yes. And it turned out, and I will show you the evidence from now. So that's the background. Why talk is cheaper than antibiotics, apart from doing less harm to the children? So what I did, I had 50 non-prescription and 50 prescription. I put them, the transcripts. Would you believe, when I put them in two stacks, the prescriptions, if they weighed 2 kilos, the non-prescription bundle weighed 10 kilos. So it was evident from that little comparison that there is more talk in non-prescription and there is less talk in prescription. And how is that? So this is about URTI for children and possibly caused by parental pressure as far as the GPs were concerned. So I took 50 cases of prescription clinic, prescription outcomes and 50 cases of non-prescription. So first observation, the non-prescription consultations are usually longer, even twice as long, in duration than the prescription consultation. So more talk regarding symptoms and more talk during physical examination. And that became the difference between the two. In the prescription case, physical examination was taken very quickly, after a few seconds. In non-prescription case, it came much later and consistently in the two groups. And thirdly, and more interestingly, because I was looking at them systematically, the prescription ones were very disorganized in terms of the structure. So symptoms are coming up everywhere. And treatment options are talked about 5 times. Whereas they're trained to do it systematically in 6 phases. It should be very orderly. So, interestingly, the non-prescription outcomes were very loose, chaotic. And the prescriptions were very systematic. So you can get a visual picture of this. So I can see what is happening on the left-hand side and the turns when it is happening. So symptoms, treatment, again symptoms, examination, diagnosis, treatment, symptoms, treatment, then close. And this is a prescription one, which has only about 40 turns, if you like. Compare that to a non-prescription one. It is 3 times longer. That was 40, this is about 120. Already it shows a lot is going on. Then you see symptoms appear 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times, 7 phases. How can you still talk about symptoms when you're supposed to be closing the conversation? So that means there might be something the patient hasn't, the mother hasn't said, so let's find out again. So this became a kind of a way in which I got interested in, so what is happening with the symptoms in prescription and non-prescription cases? And this is the instance. In the prescription ones, if there are 3 instances of symptoms talk, in the non-prescription it was more than twice, 7 instances. So on the one was 31% of the talk, the other one was 54% of the talk. And what was happening then, and I had just given you a cue yesterday, online and offline commentary. And this is the difference that it was making. If you look at football or tennis or cricket, we have commentators. Okay, they tell us what's going on. This is very different in radio as opposed to TV and all the rest of it, and sports-wise, but we know what a commentary is. A commentator talking about what's happening. So let's make a difference between online commentary, like the sports commentator, and offline commentary. So an online commentary is the kind of talk when a physician is doing something, seeing something in the stethoscope or doing an examination, an ultrasound or something. So whatever you are seeing, feeling and hearing, you are talking. I can see this, now I can see this, okay, now here is the fetus and so on and so forth. So that's online commentary. So you are talking as you are doing. An offline commentary is when you stop talking about what's going on and give an explanation. Say, oh, that happens when the fetus moves away and we have to do a caesarean. So that's an explanation. That's an offline because it's not what you're doing. So let's look at this example and you can see what is online and what is offline. The offline is in bold. The online is underlined. So here is a child, the UTRI that we are talking about. So the doctor is doing the test and says, he has got a little bit of red down here across his back, snotty nose. He has got a little bit of a wheeze in his chest. And then an explanation. That happens when the airways get a wee bit inflated, a wee bit makes it wheezy. And if that gets down into the airways, we call it bronchiolitis. And again, that's a virus infection. So that part sounds like an education, educating the parent, an explanation. And his breathing is okay, and he's not having any problem with it, and the rate at which he's breathing, is fine, and then an explanation. Sometimes, with this kind of bronchitis or babies, because the airways are already tightening, because babies are small, and if this swells up, we get to run into little problems with breathing. And once you notice that he's running into that kind of problem, you start to breathe consistently. So what happened in this study, and the findings were, the more the doctors spoke during physical examination, the more the parents said, we don't want antibiotics. So it is the parents who wanted to show their dispreference for antibiotics because they have understood something. So now they understood, okay, it will go away, they just have to be a bit patient, and so on and so forth. And this kind of commentaries can happen in any kind of, I mean, I have looked at primary care, ultrasound exams, bedside teaching, emergency medicine, multi-professional teams, preparations for surgery like anesthesia, but also in medical emergency calls. Some doctors do talk during physical examination, others don't say a word. Yesterday I mentioned about the ultrasound and those minimal noises that meant so much for the pregnant woman and the companion. The more you talk during this physical examination, because the parents are anxious, they can't see what you are seeing. And if you don't say what you are seeing, they become very scared and they think of the worst. And the more you talk about what you can see, the more they're reassured that you are sharing. It's called joint seeing. Sometimes you can even show them a little bit what can be shown. So this is one example of trying to manage communication either through active listening like we saw, but also through this kind of explanations and so on. And there could be many other examples that you can think of. So we'll stop here and close the session, unless you have some questions or comments. I think I had a slide looking at what can we do about this, but let me see if I can find it. Something I thought we could discuss, but of course I knew there would be no time. Okay, why don't I just say these things? Can I have the full screen? Okay, I think just some key points I have been trying from yesterday. That communication and consultation or your clinical expertise, they're not two different things, that we should think about them as being integrated, as part of the same thing. So your expert knowledge in science, in clinical, organizational ways, must also be part of your communication agenda. And I do not believe that you do not have the communicative and interactional expertise you all have in your own specialisms. So it's not about you don't know and you need training, but to understand and reflect on why something works and why something doesn't. So there is a lot of studies showing that all healthcare professionals understand communication very well, even if they don't talk about it. So what is it that makes you so good, and what can be shared amongst junior doctors and colleagues? No. Doesn't work again. Okay. So I always say communication is not a pill. You can't just give doctors and say, now you'll be okay. And communication is not something that is a driving license which doesn't expire. So new challenges, new diseases require new kind of communication skills. And this is the challenge. I was quoting him before, and he says, achieving the balance between a scientifically based medical education and one that introduces these new human, communication-based, reflective approaches to training, more caring and socially aware doctors, all without overcrowding the curriculum, is the major problem that faces medical education today.
Sir, I have one question.
Yeah.
Regarding the antibiotic over-prescription, whether they compare the outcomes in the two groups, prescription group and non-prescription group?
Well, I did that because I had the whole transcript.
Outcome is equal for this.
Yes, because I mean, what I was trying to say is, of course, it was evident in the transcript whether they were prescribed or not. So I knew that already. So I already knew the outcomes. But I wanted to see whether there was...
Is the consultation time?
Not just the consultation time. I also said when was the physical exam done? What was happening during the physical examination? So it is not just the time, but also what was happening during that time. Of course there is, but
in India, I think
but yeah, but parents can be very for everything there are guidelines, but what happens in the clinic is not according to guidelines. But parents can be very pressurizing, particularly literate middle class parents. Yeah, of course, of course. And sometimes you just give in to the pressure. We call it, I don't know if you have this expression, we call it the heart sink patient. Have you heard this expression? It is the patient when they arrive at your consultation door, your heart sinks. They're called heart sink. Oh, not that person again. I'm sure you have the difficult patients. They will not go away until they have asked 40 questions. And by the time you say they are finished, they say, doctor, I have one more thing. So these are the patients who take up your time, your energy, and actually in the end, and this is very important, in the end, they haven't asked the most important question. So when people ask too many questions, they don't know what is the priority. So they might have left the clinic without asking the main question why they came for. So these are the heart sink patients. So heart sink parents, not just patients. Well, these are the kind of things that you try to explain in some cases. You try to say, you know, what are the side effects of... But this is where to say that I prescribed antibiotics for non-medical reasons must be ethically very depressing. So if you are forced to prescribe because the mother wants to go to travel and the husband is not home, and that's the reason. And actually there are instances, if I look at the data, I can show you that there are completely non-medical reasons where antibiotics was prescribed. And one of the doctors had a strategy of giving an empty prescription. Okay? Just signed. He said, if you are not convinced that the cold will not disappear or whatever else, you can take it to the pharmacy and get it. And many of them didn't use it. So that's a strategy, but that is depending on what the system is.
Well, your system is completely different.
Surely, yes.
If you have not prescribed an antibiotic, again that patient will go to chemist.
Of course.
And he will tell, you go to the doctor and ask that doctor, I think doctor has forgotten to write the antibiotic.
I think it is all happening, the more patients are becoming digitally literate. This is the challenge, they are getting to know everything. They're not only asking for an antibiotic, they're telling you which one when they come. Can you please write it down? I've already written it down.
I have taken so 5 antibiotics, I think you can write another 3 or
not. Yeah. I'll finish it. There is something, if you have not heard, in US that is called the Mayo Clinic. It's a very private, very... So when they practice these kind of settings, they give a computer to the patient and a computer for the doctor. Not just the screen, the keyboard as well. So then they talk about symptoms, they talk about the differential, you know, things, side effects. And by the time the doctors have got to any point, the patients have already gone there. They know how to Google fast. So before the doctor says anything, they'll say, no, no, I don't think I would take that because I have already read the side effects. So medical practice is transforming. It is, I mean, in India it might take a bit longer than US and elsewhere, but it will happen. With insurance, with privatized care, as it must be in Odisha, they don't want you. They will just go to the private medical doctor. It's just like in US. If you have an insurance, you can ask for what you want. So medicine is like food. Take away food. You can just order it and get it. Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Om Shanti. Professor Sarangi Bhai Ji ka bahut bahut dhanyavad. जो आपने सेंसिटिव कम्युनिकेशन इन हेल्थ सेक्टर के विषय पे हमें बताया, हम सभी एक हाथ की ताली से इनको धन्यवाद देंगे।